must constantly look at things in a different way.
The Healthcare Education Transformation Podcast was created by two physical therapists out of the desire to learn more about the different educational roles in physical therapy and healthcare, and how healthcare education works by talking with educational leaders and people with different perspectives within physical therapy and across interdisciplinary lines on how education can be improved to disrupt the status quo of healthcare education. This is our journey, and thanks for listening. Hey, everybody. Thank you for listening to the Healthcare Education Transformation Podcast, as we greatly appreciate your support to help us advance healthcare education. We are very happy to announce that we have created a new tool to help develop clinicians into better experts. With that being said, we have created the HET Light tool, which LIGHT stands for Learning Integrated Towards Expertise. And what we've done is we've taken our first year's worth of episodes with experts in the fields of healthcare and education, and we've taken one golden nugget or theory on expertise and presented it to you in a very easily consumable format so that people can take one lesson or nugget per week and map out and plan how to incorporate it into your clinical and educational practices. And by the end of the year, we think you'll be pleasantly surprised at how far you've progressed towards becoming an expert. To find out more, please check it out at pteducator.com/HET, which is also available in our show notes. Thank you again all for your continued support, and now for the show.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Healthcare Education Transformation Podcast. I'm your host, F. Scott Feel, and as always, I'm here with my co-host, Brandon Pone. And actually, tonight we have two very special women on the podcast, Sarah Haig and Sandy Hilton, in which actually is our first live podcast with our guests. Because of some technical difficulties that we think may or may not have been contrived in a somewhat sneaky manner, this has brought us to our first live episode. Well, ladies, thank you so much for joining us in New Orleans here at CSM. I'm super excited to be here. You know, we can't thank you enough for coming on the show again. Is there anything I'd like our audience to know about you?
You know, one of the things that I am horrible at, this is Sandy, is marketing myself. I have a book I co-authored, Why Pelvic Pain Hurts, and I've been published in a couple different journals on what to do in treating pelvic pain. And I always forget to say that.
Yeah, I love it. That's great info.
And I actually have been starting to assist more, teaching the DPT students at Rosalind Franklin University with lab assisting and giving a couple lectures. And my favorite one so far has been stuff I wish I would have known sooner. All the stuff you learn in school that you need for your boards that ends up not being very helpful in the clinic. Hoping to help other people have a shortcut to things that took me like 5 or 6 years to figure out on my own.
Very, very valuable stuff for sure. And, you know, I actually had the pleasure of meeting you guys for the first time at CSM last year. So this is kind of an annual reunion for me. Got to stop in Chicago for a brief stint last year. But yeah, just really excited to be here again and be with you guys live. This is actually really cool. So I really consider you two my phone-a-friend option when I have options regarding pelvic health. Can you kind of lead us down the paths of expertise in the world of all things pelvic health and what led you to where you are now?
I just got lucky. I was in the right place at the right time. It was something that interested me because it's not something that I learned in school. So, and still to this day, 15 years, almost 16 years after I graduated, you know, pelvic health, how the pelvis functions isn't really covered very well. But the brief bit it was mentioned is that, like, God, pee in your pants would suck, and PT can help with that. So I just happened to start working at the Rehab Institute of Chicago as they were starting women's health program and started learning. And then they said, who wants to treat men? I said, why doesn't anyone want to help the men? And I raised my hand. And it just snowballed from there, because the more you learn, the more you realize you don't know and that you have more questions. So then you just start seeking out other people like Sandy, who can start answering more questions about the stuff you need to know.
And we men appreciate all the help that you give, believe me. I've been very fortunate to not have any issues, but I know a lot of men that have, and I personally don't want to deal with it. So I love being able to turn to you guys for it.
And I started pelvic health with men. In the beginning, I was totally going to just do strokes and head injuries and spinal cord injuries, and then I moved, and there wasn't a good place, so then I ended up in ortho, and then I moved, and where I ended up next-ish, I was getting these guys sent, had problems having sex, and it was mechanical low back pain. And eventually, I went to the doctor that was sending them to me and said, why don't you send women? And then he sent women, and I had no idea what to do with them because it's different. And so that I slid into pelvic health. I say it's because I had a big mouth.
Yeah,
and,
pun intended.
And so many people need it that I really wish that every physical therapist had at least glancing bit of information of knowing how to screen appropriately and refer appropriately. And I'll put a plug in for Sarah's class. She does a pelvic health for the non-internal therapist course, so that if you're afraid of talking about this, we can unscare you.
Yeah, pants on, gloves off. Like,
nice.
So yeah, I just came up with that. Did you like that?
Yeah. You heard it here first, folks.
Hands on, gloves off.
Yeah, no, it's because really it interests me how orthopedic, I mean, I'd say more orthopedic than neurotherapists are just like, well, you know, I really don't do the pelvis. I mean, I'll do hips, I'll do SI, I'll do low back, yeah, but I don't do the pelvis.
Can't talk about sex.
And right, you're like, yeah, but you're skipping one of the most important, most fun muscles in the body. I don't really understand how you think you can ignore it.
Yeah, no, I think those are some really interesting points. And, you know, of course, you know, ladies, with you both kind of doing kind of this more unique area of practice and more specialized area that perhaps not a lot of people have a lot of experience with, do you think you can kind of tell our listeners as to some of the more common issues that you're seeing in the male patients coming in your clinics these days?
I'll go. So we're staring at each other trying to say, who's talking first? This is Sandy. I treat mostly pain issues, so testicular pain, penile pain, pain after orgasm, pain that prevents you from getting an orgasm, because that really kind of ruins the mood. Problems sitting, because it hurts if you sit too long, because it actually hurts when you sit too long, not because it's a disease or anything like that. Those kind of issues that are barriers to where the pain is getting in the way from the things that you want to be doing or need to be doing. So we address pain to let you get back to normal function.
Yeah, and then I'd say I probably see more of the gentlemen who are having preoperatively before their prostatectomies and then postoperatively for issues they may be having. So typically the two things that happen the most after a prostatectomy is impotence and incontinence. And unfortunately, the incontinence usually resolves prior to the return of sexual function. So it's actually a really neat population in my mind to work with, because these are generally otherwise pretty healthy men that I end up seeing in my clinic. I think a lot of the patients are told to come from this particular practice, but only a few do. So I imagine they're interested in maintaining their function. But it's really neat because cancer's scary. But the great news is with prostate surgery and the treatment these days is you'll live. You have like 100% chance of living like 5 years, and you have like a 97% chance of living for 10 years. To live all those years wet and impotent is daunting for a lot of them. So it's a really neat population to try to help get them back to their lives faster.
And I used to treat pre and post prostatectomy, and then I started working with Sarah, and the first eval she did, I was like, yeah, and I'm done, because she's so good at taking these scared, really scared guys, and they come in and they're talking really fast and their voice is really intense, and they're like this. By the time they leave, they're just chilled out chatting, and it's so cool to hear that. Catching them and helping them figure out, there's a plan, we know what to do, here's the research, I'm here to help you. And it's just exquisitely well done.
Yeah, I'm over here wincing at literally every possible outcome that you guys described that I could come in with. So again, thank you for that.
Well, you know, and that's part of why we make the clinic nice, because people aren't coming just to say hi. They're coming because there's a problem.
Something wrong. But then also, you know, I know that this is more about educating professionals, but to be honest, 98%, I would say, of what I do with these gentlemen, and I know what you do with your guys in pain, is education. Is that trying to figure out how to deliver the most helpful message.
Right. Yeah, and really, which is why I love learning about learning, learning about teaching, is because you're looking at this person trying to figure out, how am I going to deliver this knowledge in a way that's going to stick for you, that you can then go use. And that's a moving target.
Yeah, for sure. Knowledge transfer of a very sensitive subject is an art form.
Yeah, when you're really, really wound up and not in the most receptive space of your life.
For sure. Oh, yeah, totally. And they're probably just worried because they're like, man, do I want to talk about this with someone?
Well, and the fact that we're women, it's, you know, it's funny. People are very sensitive right now about jokes and stuff like that. But honestly, when men make the jokes in the clinic, it's so easy to roll right over it, because you know, they're scared and trying to
break
make,
the ice.
Yeah, they're trying to make themselves feel a little bit less awkward. But luckily, I do think we have an environment and I would say a delivery where we can mitigate that awkwardness pretty quick.
Delivery matters a lot, right? Like with anything.
For anything,
We joke about the, when you have a question, you can say, walk me through this and help me understand, or walk me through this. And it's a whole different little head that you get from how it's delivered.
For sure.
And that in-person cues that you get.
Yeah,
totally. And, you know, ladies, I know you both kind of mentioned and kind of touched on this next question here a little bit, but I'm going to kind of ask to kind of get into a little bit more detail here. So, of course, men's and women's health, pelvic health issues can be a relatively sensitive subject. And, you know, with this one, pun only partially intended on this one. But what are some of the big techniques that you guys use to teach and educate patients on these diagnoses and treatments for these more sensitive type issues that perhaps most therapists just don't have the experience or the opportunity to treat?
I can go first. I'd say actually a lot of the time I start with what their situation isn't, and I want to know more about what they think it is. Because where they're coming from, even if it is, I don't want to say just incontinence, but I'll say just incontinence, their understanding of why it's happening and how it's happening, then I can just address that. And so that takes away some of the awkwardness, I think, right away, because we're no longer going, tell me about the most embarrassing things that are happening to you right now. It's more about, so there's stuff happening. What do you think is going on? Why do you think it's happening? And then we can address those. And it's, I don't know, it's not too hard to continue from there.
Right. They start asking those open-ended questions and saying, tell me about and what you've done and what you think helps you and what hasn't helped you, helps to frame how those questions are going to go next. What I don't want to do is just throw facts at people.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, I'm really trying to get them to ask me questions that I can answer or have them just kind of create an opening for that.
I think that was beautiful. Also, another pun a little bit. But like to have that opening where, again, that in that environment that we have tried to create and to just shut up and listen, most of the time they know why they're there. And if you go, what can I do to help you? Pretty quickly, they'll start to tell their story. And again, if you just shut up and listen, they will tell you more things than you could have ever gotten out of asking your questions on your page.
Yeah, and sometimes that, because I used to do that, I had my questions written down and I'd start at the top and I'd work down through them. I'd like, no, hope we'll get to that.
Yeah.
Hold that thought. And I don't do that anymore, but I understand in the beginning, you really have to be comfortable with that because you can be like, I have to hit all these points. Oh my God, you went out of order. Now I don't know where I am.
Right. I can see as a student that checklist being useful, but then as you get it into it and you get more versed and, you know, become more of an expert, you just check off the boxes as they say them and you get into each one a little bit.
And I also rely really heavily on questionnaires that people fill out ahead of time. There's a few that I really like that form a framework for asking some questions and a reason for why I ask them. And that helps me keep on track and it helps me cement that person in my head so I remember the next time they come in what they said and how we're doing and kind of the signposts I made.
For sure. Well, ladies, women's health is something that's just barely touched upon in most PT schools these days. At best, it may be an elective class. What is some advice you would give to PT students or new grads looking to immerse themselves in this specialty field of physical therapy?
So I'm totally biased, Liz, but I'd say get on Twitter, follow hashtag Pelvic Mafia, reach out to Sandy and I directly, and, you know, to kind of, if you're interested in doing a clinical, it's really interesting how students have ended up at Entropy. And most of them are people who said, I want to do this. And their schools are like, And
they find us on Twitter and their CCIs contact us and say, you will pick the student.
Repeatedly until Sandy says, okay. But it really is
sounds
about
like Jedi mind tricks.
I know, it's pretty much. But, it's if they are really interested, there are clinicians all over the country who are willing to speak with them if they ask. There are clinicals that are willing to have happened if they ask and they're willing to do the work. Because that's, yeah.
And I would say, this might come across wrong. I mean it in the kindest possible way. Do you love it when sentences start like that? If you're a student and you want to get into this and you go talk to your school and they say, we can't help you. Oh, that's fine that they can't help you, but there's a whole rest of the world out there that can. So don't let that no be the end, because it might just very well be that the school does not have the facilities to be able to help you.
Right.
Good news is there's other places.
Yeah, fight for your right to party, for sure.
Right?
Yeah.
And I, the next two students that I have coming to interview are people that, that what was available to them was not what they wanted, or especially the guys are told we don't have affiliations for men that are interested in public health.
Yeah.
And that's, it's like, no, absolutely no, that's the wrong answer. So, yeah, that's probably the quickest way to get an internship at Entropy is to contact me and say, my school told me I can't have an affiliation in public health. I'm like, oh, hell yeah, you can.
No, it's great. And, you know, ladies, I'm going to kind of ask a follow-up question here, just because I know we've talked kind of briefly here about the education of this topic through the DBT curriculum and the clinical education component. But now I'm going to switch gears and kind of ask more about kind of the post-professional path. And, you know, I realized before as well that people didn't go to the women's health residency program, but I'm kind of curious, what in your guys' opinion is the optimal way for a clinician who's wanting to become more specialized in pelvic health? Should it be either like CEU courses, or the women's health residency program, or any other things that you can think of? And kind of your thoughts on why one way would be better than the other to kind of help that clinician find out what's the best route for them to get better at this.
I got some stuff.
I guess that's it. Okay, I'm going to go first. I don't know if you guys can tell our voices apart. Sometimes people confuse us, which is hilarious. You have to take a course. You need really any of the series, whether it's through any of the companies, I'll keep this neutral, any of the companies or organizations that put on courses in the U.S. or Canada, there are great places to take some good con ed. Take the series. Pick one. Take those. Certifications don't mean you're good at it. They mean you've got a certification. And that's different from the board certification. I mean, like, look, I'm certified in what? It doesn't really mean you're going to be better at teaching patients than anyone else who doesn't have that. Mm-hmm. But you do need that series. And then I would, so get that. And then I would say, take a look at where your particular interests lie and go to a good international conference on it. Because, and I will say international full from the very beginning, because they're moved all around the U.S. and everywhere I've lived does the best therapy ever, which is different than other places around the country. There's a lot of ways to do this. Don't get stuck in the place where you live if it doesn't fit your style. Look globally. There's some cool stuff out there.
I'll just jump in on that little bit right there, is that also because healthcare systems are different. And it's really, for me, when we look at practice and payment are two different things that have to jive. And it's amazing to speak with other people. So just today we had Kari Bo from Norway. Yeah, Oslo, Norway. And it was interesting how she's just like, this is, if you need to do it, you do it and you make it work. And a couple people piped up on like billing and how would we do that here? And those are two different questions. And it's neat to hear what other people are doing that's, they're finding to be best practice. And I think we need to take that and figure out how to make it happen here. So anyway, it just gives you a totally different lens to look at it when you look at how people are treating in different zones.
So the it's how do I learn the physiology and what's the best practice to help these people reach their goals, not how do I get paid to do it? Because that is insurance therapy, not physical therapy. And it may not get them helped because Medicare, strictly speaking, doesn't care if you're incontinent. So if that's the only diagnostic code, you might get denied treatment because they're not obligated to pay for it. That doesn't mean that there isn't help for that person. So I think we have to be very careful in our education to separate what do we know about how humans are going to be best helped from who's going to pay for it.
Right. This is not a knock on any sort of business model or anything, but at the end of the day, there is a portion in our practice act that says we do need to help people.
We need to help people.
Even if it's pro bono work.
Right?
I mean, that's it. I mean,
if you can't do it, find someone who can.
Exactly.
But don't tell them they can't get help just because
they won't get reimbursed. No. Exactly.
Yeah, well, and I would say, so you mentioned residency, and I would say residency is one hell of a commitment. So if someone is looking to get into women's health or pelvic health and hasn't had much experience, I'd say that is jumping straight into the deep end with some rocks in your pockets. And you just got to cross your fingers that you're going to love it. I really like the idea of thinking on why you want to do pelvic health and think about what you're willing to do and just take that first step. So is it a level one? Is it a course like mine where you get to talk about all things pelvis but not have to actually touch any vaginas?
Or rectums.
So, you know, figure out, like, what am I thinking? Find that class. And again, like, level ones through any of the amazing organizations is a great start because you can be like, that was way cooler than I thought it was to do a vaginal exam. Or you could be like, yeah, I'm done. I was wrong. This is is not for me. And so to just think about why you want to do it and what you're hoping to help people with and start learning.
Yeah.
Pick something and take a step.
Yeah. And you should love it, and it should make you really happy to be doing it. And if that's not true, then do something else.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think those are some good points. And, you know, ladies, with both of you being some pretty extravagant conference goers, I'm kind of curious then, you know, for a clinician who's wanting to go down this route too, what are some of the top conferences that you guys would recommend to kind of become better or learn more about pelvic health?
To learn more about pelvic health, top conferences.
Do you have something to say?
Go, well, in the U.S., your options are here at CSM or the International Pelvic Pain Society, which, while it says international, pretty much only holds its stuff here. And those are good. IASP is my favorite for pain, but I'm a pain person. IUGA, there's a lot. I'm throwing out initials that don't mean anything to a lot of people.
Yeah, there's the international.
We can put the links in the show notes. We'll take care of that.
The International Continence Society is actually happening in Philadelphia this fall.
Truly an international conference.
Truly an international conference. And yeah, so there's a World Congress on Abdominal and Pelvic Pain, which I would recommend.
2019
in London. Ooh. Yes, and more international. But also, I would, anyone who wants to get into pelvic health, we also really encourage them to not forget that that's attached to a person with other pieces. So, like, one of the things that I love the most is actually the International Back and Neck Pain Forum. You take your rudimentary knowledge of the pelvis and you go hang out with a bunch of back pain nerds. And researchers.
And the people who are putting all this conference just went, oh, but thanks for the plug.
No. Honestly, it's one of my favorite ones for a lot of reasons. If you want to get into pelvic health, don't have tunnel vision.
Right. Uh-huh. And we call it putting it back in the body. So for the people who work with spine and hip and leg and
just
stuff.
Just keep on rolling tonight.
To remember inside to the pelvis. Despite all of the ortho books out there that forget there's an inside to the pelvis, those things are pretty important. And for the pelvic health therapist to remember that there's other parts attached.
Yeah, it's more than a pelvic floor.
And so really, it's just whole person treatment.
Yeah,
we just talk about the fun pieces.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. I think that leads actually perfectly into my next question here, which is, you know, ladies, with you guys having a lot of experience in these specific realms here, I'm kind of curious if you wouldn't mind kind of sharing with some of our listeners in terms of what are some of the top overall clinical pearls that you guys have learned based on what the research says that perhaps is relatively slow to adopt among other pelvic health practitioners kind of throughout the U.S. and the world, frankly, for that matter, that you think people should know?
I think we should jump completely and totally into the International Association for the Study of Pain's guidelines for how to treat people that hurt, regardless of what body part hurts, and that we should not treat pelvic pain fundamentally any different than any other pain. There's no reason to think the cortical structures or the muscles or ligaments or tendons or anything else would function differently than for shoulders or knees or necks or whatever. There's certainly some extra psychosocial and physiological things that come with pelvic issues, but the pain can be addressed similarly, and we could stop. We could adapt all the things that have been told around backs that we could forget to check for, and we can de-adopt those in pelvic health as well.
So I should warn you that I'm wearing my sassy pants and just spent the entire day in a really amazing,
fired up,
a really amazing, completely.
It was
a completely evidence-based thing, and this was like my dream talk because what the speaker did was, you know, there's a lot of common misconceptions, and I think currently a lot of times we're told something, and if we're told that by someone in authority, be it your DPT program, your mentor at work, someone you really respect online, you kind of take it as truth and you don't fact check it. And what happens is you get really silly things happening. Like you get women who have had children who were told to not pick up more than 25 pounds because their uterus will just fall right out of their vagina, or their diastasis will burst wide open. And it's not true. It's just not true. So I think that as you learn things and you to really challenge yourself to think about why you're doing what you're doing, and then to go check the evidence, to go see what do we know and what do we not know. So here's my clinical pearl, is there is no exercise that has been proven to be good or bad for a diastasis. So if you have someone with that separation of their abdominal muscles, they're often told to not plank, they're often told to not rotate, they're often told to not lift too much, and
be scared.
And they're scared. I had one lady not lift her arm over her head for a year because she was told it would overstretch her tissues.
So there, and back check. I guess mine, if I was going to do a clinical pearl, is please remember biological plausibility. Mm. And when someone tries to convince you that something has exceptionally great results, they should have exceptionally great data to back that up.
Yeah.
And because I see it in my practice, while that is good, is not data, and it doesn't back it up.
And speaking of research, I want to give a plug to you. We were talking about this earlier before the show. Clinical prediction guideline.
Well, practice guidelines.
Clinical practice guidelines. Sorry. I mean, the amount of research that is out there and the fact that we're finally narrowing it down and getting it to a point where we can finally look at it and make good decisions, it's there for a reason. We might as well use it.
And the APTA, and here's a plug, the APTA has a page with all the clinical practice guidelines on it. Please use them. Please look at them, but question them.
Yeah.
Because it takes 4 or 5 years, if you're lucky, to from the beginning to the end to get it done, and you're already out of date as soon as it's done. So you can't just read the clinical practice guidelines and say, now I know everything. You need to read them and then do a PubMed search and see how you're doing. And yeah, I think
and
clinicians...
then years down the line, that research is going to be updated anyway. So you've got to keep on top of it. You've got to keep you know,
isn't
learning.
Isn't that exciting?
Yeah,
because it's not just like we have to pull out the low back pain recipe.
Right.
We get to treat people, right, and they're messy, and it's changing. And that's what keeps therapy fun.
For sure. Well, ladies, thank you so much for your time and for coming on the show again, the second mm-hmm. time. Here at CSM Live. It was awesome. I had a blast. We'd like to end each episode by asking all of our guests this question. If you could change one aspect of higher education, DPT or otherwise, what aspect would you change and how would you change it?
I should remember this from the last time we did this podcast.
Well, I was
just stalling.
I kind of feel like we might say the same thing. I honestly, the one thing I would change is to really give a good basic education on the function of the pelvic floor, the function of the pelvis, and the interventions that are appropriate for physical therapists to do, and the evidence that supports it. We have amazing evidence, better evidence for treating incontinence than pretty much anything else, yet we don't teach it. So I would say let's get into the pelvis and teach people at least basics. They don't have to do it, but they have to know it.
So since Sarah said that, I'll get another one. I will say that I would like to have everyone that graduates from PT school to be exceptionally good critical thinkers and an ability to read the evidence well and understand how to apply it or throw it out if it's not needed.
And especially at the DPT level, that's where we should be.
We should be.
Moving mm-hmm. from the master's to the DPT, I feel like we should have evolved to that at the very least.
Yeah, and I would say, honestly, based on the things I hear from new grads and DPT students, that is... It's not happening everywhere.
I've met some who
it does happen, but too often it's like, but that's not what they taught me in school.
Well, and to be honest, I don't think that they can, because then you'll never pass your boards.
Right.
Fair.
Right. Touche.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of other factors that are involved in that decision for sure. Definitely not.
Your boards and like, wait, no, that's not true. I just read that CPT and then you'll all flunk.
Right.
So what happened?
Well, there's even some seeing stuff similar with even board specialty exams too.
Yeah.
A lot of OCS people have been saying things like, well, that's kind of out of date, but it's on the test.
Right, and that I think that is ultimately harmful to practice.
Absolutely.
Because then you have people who consider themselves specialists that are practicing in outdated patterns because it was on the test.
Yeah.
And that is not good for a profession.
Yeah, I as a CS, I totally agree that when I walked out of that test, I was like, I hope I guessed right, because there were lots of things on there that just wrong, actually.
And I almost feel like, as terrible as this sounds, we almost need to preface the certifications at this point with the best possible formulation we had at the time the test was created, and we're constantly a work in progress.
So then is there a reason to get certified?
I would argue no, but...
Nope.
You know that.
I would as well,
Oh, wait, we're unanimous on the no.
Yeah.
Well, then that makes an interesting follow-up question for you, gentlemen. What about the APTA's discussion about whether or not residencies and fellowships and certifications should be mentioned?
We have had a lot of guests on to discuss that, and Brandon actually just started a little bit of mini-series that dabbles into stuff like that. And I think the way that the clinical task force ended was a great way to see where we're at. Inconclusive. That's where they ended.
It'd be really fun if you've gotten someone from some other country that doesn't teach in the U.S. and isn't affiliated with any U.S. program, ask them.
Yeah.
We're all human on the planet,
I think the miniseries needs to add a new feature, an out of the country guest.
I think that's a really good idea because we definitely have a few aspects that we can use for that. But no, kind of going at that, you know, to that follow up question for there, at least from my very limited perspective, I personally think that I don't think that board certification really holds a lot of value because I think that really you're frankly just studying for a test that really isn't going to help you much in the real world. And it's a lot of money for something that's not going to help me a lot. Like, I'm all about spending money for something that's going to help me, but I'm not going to spend something for something that's not. And that's just my opinion on that one. But in regards to residency, I think it's more of a trickier issue because I'm a little biased with how I came from my school. But to me, at least, I do think that in some way, shape, or form, it shouldn't necessarily be mandatory, but I think we should try to eventually work towards it being something along the lines of more of a expected normal continuum, because I do agree that based on where we're at after school, we're termed, and Bob Rowe even said this, we're termed a basicist, which means we know the basics of how to do certain things, but we can't even classify as a generalist because that would imply we're more specialized than that. So then the problem is that a lot of new grads are going out into more specific fields more often than not. Now, not everyone, and I realize that, but the fact is that just the CAPTI requirements that, you know, that someone's going through DPT education is not specific for that specialist model. And I think that if that's the realm someone want to go, I think in some way, shape, or form, in an ideal situation would be good. The problem is we don't have the capacity, the debt, And there's so many other factors to why that's not possible right now, and I don't think it's necessarily the best thing as it stands now. But I think in an ideal world, if everything was controlled and it wouldn't increase student debt and we had the capacity to be able to accommodate that, I think having it as a normal continuum for people that knew what they want to do in some way, shape, or form integrated would not be a bad thing.
See, I think that it would be really cool if I could do it over. I would have chosen a PT school where the people that taught at that school were skilled and had done research in something I was interested in. But at the time, I just wanted to get into a school, any school, give me a school, and whatnot. Great. So if residencies were done like that, where, like, for instance, if I was interested in whiplash disorders, I would go do a residency with Jim Elliott, hands down. And if I couldn't get one with him, I probably wouldn't do one. Because why? Just to check a block. That's a very expensive block to check. So I'm curious about them from that perspective, if there's a person you want to learn from, but to just have one to say you have one doesn't really appeal to me.
Yeah, and for me, I think it goes back to actually, like, we all kind of agree that the WCS or the CS test, any certification test, is going to be out of date just by the nature of how you have to create a test and all of this stuff. And a residency is obviously a structured learning environment where you get to practice and you also have a mentor and there's also a didactic portion. And my question is how is that didactic portion going to be differently? And how are you going to find those mentors who haven't gone through a residency, right? So like in the women's health world, like the residency has only been around for 5 or 6 years. And so Sandy and I, neither one of us are residents. I'd argue that we'd be really fine mentors.
I'm not even a CS because they're not gained clinical specialist.
But, you know, you have to look at, so then who's teaching, who's deciding, and is it still just a matter of ticking the boxes that an administrator said need to be ticked in order to have completed a residency? Well, so I'm still uncertain.
I hate to throw another wrench into the mix here, but who are we doing this for? Like, does the general public even know what a certified specialist is?
You know what I could do without that?
Unless they Google it.
Have full direct access.
You're basically trying to show to your peers that you took the test and passed it. Like, I can't ever say that I've had a patient, you know, ever seek somebody out for a specialty.
I could see a
very few, but you're talking about a very minute percentage compared to the general health who doesn't even know what physical therapy does anyway.
They truly just want to get better. They don't care who helps them.
Right.
They just
exactly.
want to get better.
Exactly.
So sometimes I think that we are over specializing ourselves out of reach.
Can we keep talking? Do you guys got to go? Because I would say the next step, instead of focusing on all of this stuff, like the more advancing, I would say let's look at the people other people refer to as staff therapists and figure out why we call them that, because we're all professionals and we should be holding all of us up to a really lovely standard of keeping up with the evidence, treating well, and not just coming to work and going home, but treating it as a true profession.
The only difference in supervising physical therapist and staff therapist at the last job I had was the supervising physical therapist controlled the schedule.
So an administrator.
Yeah, exactly. And did a few administrative tasks. That was literally the only difference. The staff therapist, some of them had way more experience than the supervisor.
So they were just physical therapists who didn't have to do admin.
Yeah.
Sounds good to me.
That was literally, exactly. That was literally, and you know, you may have gotten a slight pay bump for doing the admin stuff, but there was no difference in the treatment philosophies. There was, you know, again, some of the staff therapists had more experience than the supervising therapists. So,
yeah, it's a weird name. Because you don't have staff lawyers.
No.
Or staff lawyers. You don't have staff lawyers. No, you're an associate or a partner.
It's ridiculous. I don't think it makes sense.
Yeah, it does not. So let's all work to be better.
I know.
They're like, please let us go. It's CSM. We want
to No, this is great. This is why I'm here. So this is great.
It's good. I think I really, this is not even a paid advertisement, but really, I really do love what you guys are doing, looking at how we're doing education.
To take a look at the
really awesome.
The pragmatic bit of what we do has to be done so that you can do it better.
Exactly. And that Brandon and I talk about this all the time. We're not only looking at physical therapy, we're looking at all healthcare professions. How do they learn?
Yep.
What are the best things from that program? Maybe we can implement it in physical therapy. Maybe we can implement this in dentistry. Maybe we can implement that in pharmacy school. Take the best of the best. Let's knock down the silos. Let's all learn together anyway, because we're going to end up having to treat a patient who's going to see all of us anyway.
See, I already told you before we started to talk to Bronnie Thompson, because this is something that Bronnie and I have talked about. She's a health skills web blog, I think is her blog.
Yep.
She's an occupational therapist and has done a phenomenal amount of work. And her and I have talked about it. It's like, it doesn't matter what credentials got you up to the top of the table to treat people. You're all there.
Yeah.
And we can learn from each other.
Absolutely.
And need to stop trying to kick each other's ladders down because there's more people that need help than are getting.
Ladies, would you mind telling our audience some of the perks Entropy Physio offers to students and clinicians with regards to continuing education, conferences, scholarships, and where they can find you guys online on social media?
I live on Twitter, Sandy Hilton PT. That's the easiest way to find me. But my email is sandyhilton@gmail.com is the one I check more often, sandy@entropy-physio. I check that it's mostly patient stuff. Perks. So 20% off for students at Entropy all the time because we
love it. And the code is DPT student. But PTA students, you are welcome to use that as well. It's just more codes and I'm lazy.
This does not count to PhD students.
Sorry. Or transitional DPTs.
Right.
Sorry. Unlicensed professionals.
Those of you who are getting paid. Let's see what else. Perks. We try and bring people to Entropy that we want to learn from, that we think are doing things that are intriguing and interesting and that are going to make you a better therapist, make you have to think a little bit and have fun thinking.
Yeah, you won't get a new technique, but you'll get a whole new way at looking at everything you've been doing. And you might not change a thing, but you'll have a little bit of a different framework and a different, better support for it. Also, we have the Epic Scholarship. So occasionally we get kind people like Lorimer Mosley and Paul Hodges who are willing to come by our clinic and have some wine and some cheese and other nibbles, and the money we make from those nights goes towards the Epic Scholarship. And the Epic Scholarship is open to everyone, even if they have a license and job. And it is to attend a conference of your choice. And it does not have to be for pain.
Doesn't have to be for pelvic stuff.
I'm currently updating the webpage for it, but basically it's a 5-minute video application. Tell us what conference you want to go to and why.
How much it will cost.
And how much you need to make it happen. And then we go from there. There is a deadline. I have to look it up. But you can check the website in the next week or so.
And the idea of it was from Lorimer Mosley and Paul Hodges and David Butler, who say that, well, that's a great question. That's a Cabernet conversation. And then they move on and they never answer the question. So it was kind of a challenge to, okay, gentlemen, can we actually have these conversations? But also to we all share a passion for trying to shorten the gap between the researchers and the clinicians and when evidence comes out about what we should do in practice and when it's implemented. So this is to get a researcher who may not be funded to go to something that they need to be at so they can continue in their research track, or a clinician that would love to go and learn something and just can't get paid for it. Because stuff's expensive, and most PT practices pay about $300 a year in funded money, and that is not enough.
And I'd say it's actually a two-way street. So not just, how can I say it? We want to get the clinicians there so that they can talk to the researchers and be like, hey, this is my clinical question. And the researchers will probably go, that's not a question you can answer, but they'll sit and they'll talk to you about it. So you can start to develop a question and have a better understanding, but also give them ideas for research. So researchers need to get funded for their research, but also nobody wants to pay to answer questions that don't matter in the world. So we can help them. Look at it that way.
Awesome. Well, thank you again so much, ladies, for your time. And I look forward to doing this again, hopefully very soon.
Sounds great.
Thank you for attending class today. And we hope that you learned something and gained value from the content.
If you'd like to schedule office hours with us, feel free to add us on Twitter at HET Podcast, on Instagram, HET Podcast, on Facebook, The Healthcare Education Transformation Podcast, and the homepage, healthcareeducationtransformationpodcast.com.
And for those of you following along in the syllabus, extra credit can be obtained by liking us, sharing us, and leaving a review.
Let's continue our journey up Mount Educational Success as lifelong learners.